if that continues, that kind of thing continues, it's probably going to force the hand of the authorities.
Protests and clashes continue in Hong Kong. It's Monday, July 22nd. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, dry and wet in Australia. Pakistan's Prime Minister is in Washington. China and Vietnam at odds. Lab-grown meat and the future of space. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Hong Kong riot police fired tear gas and rubber bullets late Sunday to disperse pro-democracy protesters who again filled the streets of the Chinese territory. Tens of thousands of demonstrators protested for the seventh straight weekend, with some defacing the Chinese national emblem on Beijing's liaison office, some threw eggs at the building, and spray-painted surrounding security cameras. Acrid clouds of tear gas enveloped the territory's dense commercial district. The protests have morphed from a call for an end to the now-suspended bill to extradite Hong Kong residents charged with criminal offenses to China for trial into demonstrations for democratic reforms and an end to Beijing's tighter grip on the territory. It is the worst social turmoil to rock the former British colony since it returned to Chinese rule 22 years ago. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Andrew Scobell, senior political scientist with the RAND Corporation, and he asked him how long these protests could go on.
Well, I guess there are three sides. The protesters, the Hong Kong authorities, and then Beijing, the national authorities in the capital, Beijing. And none of those three parties seem amenable to compromise or de-escalation. And so how long can this go on? It could go on for more weeks, but with the events that took place this Sunday, if that kind of thing continues, it's probably going to force the hand of the authorities.
Why do you think it has gone on so long, and why do you think that the scope of the protest has expanded as it has?
One of the reasons why the protests have gone on so long, I think, is because the protesters are made up of a variety of groups that have different priorities, different demands. And it's hard to get unity and cohesion. So that means that individual groups can organize protests, and then they can snowball. So it's very hard for any individual or group to organize or coordinate the protests, which makes it much more volatile, much more difficult to control. The other important reason why the protests have not slowed down or ended is because there hasn't been a acceptable or response from the authorities, whether that's the local authorities in Hong Kong or from Beijing. Of course, the one important meeting of the protesters' demands was the pulling of the extradition law, which was significant, but beyond that, there hasn't really been a clear response, and so it's both frustrated and emboldened the protesters.
What do the protesters really want? What could end these protests?
There are a variety of demands, which makes it hard for them all to be met, and very unlikely that they'll all be met. So whether some concessions on one or more of these by the Hong Kong authorities would make a difference, it's really hard to say. And to be fair to Chief Executive Carrie Lam and the Hong Kong authorities, they're really in a very difficult situation because they're under pressure, obviously, from the protesters, but they're also under pressure from Beijing to get, you know, restore order, restore stability in Hong Kong. And responding to those different pressures, I wouldn't wish on anyone.
Is everything being synchronized in these protests by social media? Is everything, or is there some kind of outside, the possibility of some kind of outside force that is taking hold of at least part of these protests?
To the best of my knowledge, these are very self-directed and driven from by Hong Kong, different groups within Hong Kong. What is also important is the perception in Beijing that there are outside forces exerting influence or manipulating or inciting these things and these events, and that makes for a great deal of paranoia and alarm if on the part of Chinese leaders, which does not augur well, I think, for the future of Hong Kong.
Andrew Scobell, senior political scientist with the RAND Corporation, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Japan's ruling coalition secures upper house majority. Hong Kong police fire tear gas to disperse protesters. U.S. advisor Bolton travels to Japan, South Korea amid trade dispute. Will Kim's claim in Constitution weaken efforts to denuclearize? Recycled water part of Perth's plan to beat climate change in Australia. You'll find all these stories and much more when you visit our Facebook page at VOA Asia, as well as the voanews.com website. Continue with VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. As drought-hit towns across New South Wales and Queensland edge closer to completely running out of water, federal and state governments in Australia are trying to come up with ways to guarantee supplies into the future. But on the other side of the continent, the city of Perth is leagues ahead in its water efficiency following a long-term decline in rainfall. Part of its survival plan relies on recycled water from toilets, a move that many consumers elsewhere still consider to be unpalatable. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has details.
Since 2017, residents in the Western Australian city of Perth have been drinking water recycled from sewage. It's filtered using a process called reverse osmosis, which is similar to forcing water through a giant sponge. It's then disinfected with ultraviolet light at a treatment plant, pumped into natural aquifers and extracted. Perth is a city of 2 million people, and Claire Lugar from Western Australia's Water Corporation says it's had to get used to climatic changes.
We know from the mid-70s onwards, Perth's rainfall has been declining by about 20%, and that's had a huge impact on our water sources that are dependent on the climate.
Lugar says convincing residents of the benefits of drinking recycled sewage did take time.
So it's only a small percentage of the water that comes into the plant that's actually from our toilets, but getting over that perception, that kind of image that you might be drinking the water that you're flushing down the toilet, that was probably one of our big challenges initially.
Two desalination plants supply about half of Perth's water. Aquifers are also crucial, but recycling produces only 2% of the total. But that figure is soon expected to rise. Ian Wright, an expert in environmental science at Western Sydney University, believes other parts of Australia should embrace recycling.
In Sydney, that's probably 150 litres per day per person of wastewater that's completely wasted. And yes, we have the availability of desalination on the coast, but Canberra doesn't have desalination. And then the poor drought-stricken towns like Tamworth and Dubbo and Broken Hill, they could really, really use that now.
Australia is the world's driest inhabited continent. Water is precious and in many places scarce. More than 95% of New South Wales, Australia's most populous state, is officially in drought, and the next 3 months are forecast to be drier than average. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, tens of thousands of demonstrators protested for the seventh straight weekend as Hong Kong riot police fired tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse pro-democracy protesters. It's the worst social turmoil in Hong Kong since it returned to Chinese rule 22 years ago. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're so happy you're with us today as we start a new week on VOA Asia. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan will meet with U.S. President Donald Trump later today at the White House. VOA's Aman Azhar spoke to experts and Pakistani residents in the United States about their expectations for the visit and filed this report narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
Since he took office in 2017, President Donald Trump has been critical of Pakistan's alliance with the United States, blaming it for failing to effectively counter extremist groups.
We're supporting Pakistan. We're giving them $1.3 billion a year, which we don't give them anymore, by the way. I ended it because they don't do anything for us. They don't do a damn thing for us.
Under Trump, the Pentagon canceled hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid to Pakistan, accusing Islamabad of giving material aid to insurgents, which Pakistan denies. Now, with the U.S. peace talks with the Afghan Taliban reportedly making headway, former U.S. ambassador to Pakistan Richard Olson says there is room for growth when it comes to bilateral ties.
I think this reflects a gradual improvement in relations between the United States and Pakistan. It's difficult to imagine this trip having taken place, say, a year ago. And I think what has changed is that there is an appreciation in Washington now that Pakistan has been very helpful on delivering peace and a political settlement in Afghanistan.
Olson also thinks the two leaders may be able to build on what they have in common.
There are certain parallels between the two individuals. They're both sort of right of center in their political contexts. Both of them have an ability actually to appeal to the religious elements of the right of center, even though they're perhaps not themselves personally religious figures. They have, of course, they've both been celebrities and had colorful personal lives. What the dynamic will be between them, I can't say. I don't think anyone can predict that.
This is Khan's first trip to the United States since becoming prime minister, leading some Pakistani Americans to hope that it could lead to a breakthrough after years of tension.
Pakistani diaspora want to see Prime Minister Khan's visit with President Trump and other government officials as a starting point. They are hoping that this vehicle continues and does not stop here, and a constructive relationship between the two leaders are built.
The Pakistani community in the U.S. is very happy for his trip to the U.S. because this can lead to an economic reform, which is really good for the country and the nation.
You know the current situation in Pakistan, and every person is hoping that Imran Khan will do something that hasn't been done yet.
The meeting raising hope the two leaders can make some headway on a peace deal in Afghanistan. For Aman Azhar, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
Coming up, a centuries-old spat continues. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
The latest news from VOA Asia. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's ruling coalition secured a majority in Japan's upper house of parliament in Election Sunday, according to vote counts by public television and other media. Exit polls indicated Abe could even close in on the supermajority needed to propose constitutional revisions. You can visit VOA Asia Facebook for more on this and other stories. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, China and Vietnam are continuing to clash over a maritime sovereignty dispute, despite diplomacy and calm being displayed by other claimants to the same area. The communist neighbors talk regularly about their differences, party to party, as well as through diplomatic channels. Yet, a new dispute erupts between China and Vietnam about once a year. They're locked in another new one now over energy exploration in an area in the sea that both countries call their own. Eduardo Arural is associate professor at the National University of Singapore's Public Policy School.
I think the big picture on China-Vietnam relations is that they would go for diplomacy and they would go for hardball games. It's a very long love-hate relation between China and Vietnam.
In the most recent clash between the two countries, a Chinese Coast Guard vessel has been patrolling since June 16th around a seabed tract about 352 kilometers off the coast of southeastern Vietnam. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings, who is following the story in Taipei. This news break from VOA Asia, the death toll climbed to 34 following an arson attack on an animation studio in western Japan. Thursday's attack on Kyoto Animation, famous in Japan and overseas for its series and movies, was the worst mass killing in two decades in a country with some of the world's lowest crime rates. You'll find all the big stories throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the latest vegetarian meat alternatives that taste and cook like real beef are all the rage in the United States. But there's also a market for lab-grown meat, which provides all the protein without the cruelty and the carbon footprint. But it's proving a tougher sell than plant-based alternatives, as we hear from VOA's Kevin Enix.
Vegetarian meat alternatives are showing up on menus all over the world. Their selling point is that even though they're plant-based, they look and taste like real chicken, fish, or beef without the cruelty or environmental and biological impact. But the next wave of cooking entrepreneurs believe consumers can have the meat they crave, but without all the concerns that come with the meat industry.
It smells fantastic.
This chicken is real, but it was grown in a lab, not on a farm, and not as a chicken, but as a collection of cells.
We take cells from high-quality animals, we feed them with the nutrients that these cells need to become meat, and once they become meat, we harvest it, and we cook it into the products we love to eat.
U.S. government officials are preparing to release regulations that will allow lab-grown meat on the market. And Uma Valenti from Memphis Meats says his company is ready to jump in.
We're actually preserving the choice of eating meat for people. Instead of saying, give up eating meat or eat a meat alternative, we're saying, continue eating the meat that you love. Let's show you how we can continue to produce it and supply it in a way that you will get behind.
It's a simple idea. Simply grow muscle and fat cells in a lab and create chicken breasts or a steak without having to create the entire animal. The challenge is getting cells to become meat and then scaling up to produce a product on the same scale and price as the beef industry provides.
How can you go from the tiny, tiny meatball to producing the amount of meat that one cow has, which is like maybe 800 pounds or so? That's the real challenge.
There's also the yuck factor. Consumers have a general distaste for what they see as genetically modified foods.
It's not clear that the consumers having the choice, they will choose for lab-grown meat.
But despite these obvious challenges, a report released in June suggests that lab-grown meat could make up about a third of all the meat the world consumes by 2040. These companies are betting on it. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
50 years ago, two American astronauts became the first humans to walk on the moon. But before humans had left Earth, animal astronauts had already blazed a trail into space. VOA's Carrie Hensley has more.
Two white mice, named Mildred and Albert, were among the first furry pioneers to go for a ride into space. The mice and their monkey companions, Patricia and Mike, were launched upward in a U.S. rocket at 3,000 kilometers per hour. They experienced the strange feeling of weightlessness as they coasted upward to an altitude of 60 kilometers.
A parachute opens to ease the rocket and its precious cargo to a gentle landing. Anxious scientists rush to the scene and discover the animal crew has weathered the flight safely.
Meanwhile, the Soviet Union was sending man's best friend into space.
This is the story of the Russian space dog and how it was trained for its fantastic job.
The most famous canine spacefarer, Laika, orbited Earth in 1957. Like all of the Soviet Union's rocket dogs, Laika was a stray. The scientists thought stray dogs would better withstand the harsh conditions inside the capsule. The United States continued to turn monkeys into astronauts. In 1959, Abel and Baker soared to an altitude of nearly 500 kilometers and made it home safe and sound. The safe return of many animals gave scientists the confidence that humans could survive a journey into space as well.
It's encouraging to us to think that an animal can be exposed to space environment conditions without having undue alterations in its basal physiology, and one can reasonably then hope that the same situation will apply to the human.
Finally, in 1961, humans followed in the paw prints of those first animal explorers.
The Earth looked a delicate blue floating in a black sky, so said the first man in space after his fabulous journey of 108 minutes, Major Yuri Gagarin, a 27-year-old Soviet Air Force officer whose name will live in history.
Now that we have made our way to space, animals still have an important role to play. Astronauts on the International Space Station study how they adjust to microgravity. These mice spent 37 days in space. While adapting to their strange habitat, they developed new behaviors like running laps in their cage. Studying animals in space can help us understand how humans might fare while living in Earth orbit, or on the Moon, or Mars, or beyond. Carrie Hensley, VOA News, Washington.
The 12 Apollo astronauts who roamed the moon nearly 50 years ago, some 50 now, collected a lot of rock samples. And those samples are still being studied by volcanologists who believe that they could learn more to more accurately predict eruptions here on Earth. Here's Faith Lapidus.
Volcanic eruptions are among the most spectacular phenomena on Earth. They were probably equally impressive 2 billion years ago on the moon. Now, remains of those ancient eruptions are helping scientists understand the unpredictable behavior of terrestrial volcanoes.
And we're looking at moon rocks because they have something very special in that they were formed in a lower gravity environment. And that changes how the crystals and the melt behave with one another as they're forming. So studies like this gives us a baseline to understand processes that happen at terrestrial gravity on Earth.
Apollo astronauts on the 6 lunar landing missions brought home nearly 400 kilograms of moon rocks, more than 2,000 separate samples.
So this one came from Apollo 15. Apollo 15 was the first mission where they had the rover, so they were able to traverse a larger area. So this is from a volcanic area, not unlike Hawaii.
NASA has loaned 18 of these rocks to Britain's Diamond Light Source, a huge cyclic particle accelerator near Oxford. Here, electrons are accelerated to close to the speed of light until they emit light 10 billion times brighter than the sun. This allows scientists to study minute specimens in extreme detail using X-ray beams, giving us a glimpse of the future from an altogether different world.
At the moment, we're facing a disconnect in volcanology where we can monitor what's happening in a volcano in the present, but it's very difficult to see the future because we have no reference to the past. But rocks contain the kind of information that we need to know to make decisions in the present, and it's about connecting them together.
And that can also help reveal how our solar system formed, how we went from a giant ball of dust to a collection of planets orbiting a star. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Perhaps you were hearing us online via iTunes or SoundCloud, or maybe on Facebook. You can catch us every day on VOA Asia Facebook. For our listeners in Myanmar, you can hear us on Facebook VOA Burmese. We thank everyone there who has listened to our program today. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Zainab Abdel-Rahman, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.